From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. We start this hour with a connection to the state capitol and our intrepid Albany correspondent, Karen DeWitt, who's been keeping tabs on what's happening in the legislature in the final days of this session. A little earlier this morning, I spoke with Karen and asked her for an update on the very latest on some of the controversies that are bubbling right now in the legislature.
Well, what's dominating everything right now is the fact that New York City's rent regulations expire at midnight tonight. And right now, the Assembly Democrats want to strengthen tenant protections. Governor Cuomo is siding with them. The Senate Republicans just want to extend the laws as they are and move on. So far, there's no agreement. Tenants in New York City are getting a bit nervous about this. Some of them are coming up to the Capitol to protest. And we're really not sure if they're going to be able to agree on this by the end of the day or do an extender for a couple of days while they try to figure out an agreement. Pretty much everything here is at a standstill, which isn't that unusual in the final days of session, but this one seems kind of even, people are even more stuck in their ways than ever. There's also an education tax credit that would allow donors to give money to private scholarships for poor students at private schools. That's hung up in the mix. And so far, it's kind of difficult to get a read on how this is all going to be resolved.
Now, of course, it's easy sitting up here in Rochester to say, I understand why somebody in Manhattan or Brooklyn is concerned about the possibility of their rent going up. But this has effects upstate as well. There's a connection upstate to tax credits as well, right?
Well, that's right. Through a complicated bit of legislation they did the last go-round with this in 2011, they tied the upstate and Long Island property tax cap, the 2% per year property tax cap, is tied to the rent laws. So if the rent laws expire, then the property tax cap also is in jeopardy. That isn't going to be renewed till next year, but they're kind of, there's an understanding that they're tied together, so that could make it less likely that that would be renewed. So everybody does have a bit of a stake in this whole thing.
And there are concerns, too, in the current environment with all the investigations and arrests that we've seen in the Capitol of even trying to make anything that vaguely resembles a deal right now, right?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, the place has just been beset by these corruption scandals. We lost the Assembly Speaker and the Senate leader. They both had to resign over corruption charges. And a lot of the cases against them center around real estate donations to their campaigns and alleged favors that they paid to the real estate companies. One of the real estate executives is a cooperating witness, and there's ongoing investigations. So they're kind of afraid to do this three men in a room deal where they make some kind of deal and say it benefits the real estate developers because there's a tax credit also tied to the rent laws that benefits real estate developers. They don't want to make it look like they're doing favors to someone who gave them campaign money, and then they end up being charged with bribery. So the old way of doing things, these secret deals where everything's glued together and what's, you know, kind of somewhat affectionately known as the big ugly, may not come to fruition because they're scared to make any deal that doesn't look up and up and above board, and that has slowed things down as well.
And of course, even if you can figure out who two of those three men in the room are even going to be this week, the third man, Governor Cuomo, has a lot of other business on his plate too, including up north with the escaped prisoners. How much attention is he able to actually focus right now on making things happen in these final hours in Albany?
Well, in addition to the escaped prisoners who still haven't been caught after 10 days, the governor just generally has not been that focused this year. His father passed away January 1st. His longtime partner, Sandra Lee, the celebrity chef, had breast cancer and had major surgery. He's got new leaders to deal with in the legislature who are still a bit, you know, shaky, haven't completely consolidated their power. And he just seems off his game. He's not kind of the star of the narrative stepping in and going to fix everything. In fact, he's been warning that there might be chaos and mayhem if the laws expire. And it does seem like he's a bit off his game, and that's affecting things as well. In some ways, it kind of feels like we might be slipping back to that pre-Cuomo era dysfunction that Albany was so famous for. But, I guess I would withhold judgment on that until we see what happens at the end of the day. It could still all come together this evening. I've seen it happen before.
You've seen pretty much everything happen, I think, over your years in Albany. If you were a betting woman right now, is it most likely that we just get short-term extenders and this gets pushed off? And if so, until when? Or do you think it's really possible that this could all come together before the end of the day?
Yeah, I think that they'll probably do like maybe a couple-day extender, and it may be that they just extend all these rent laws related real estate development tax credit, all these other things, they just extend them for either 6 months or a year. Presumably then the federal probes will be done and they'll know the total fallout from that, and then they'll feel like they could more freely be able to make deals again.
WXXI's Karen DeWitt in Albany with us on Connections. I hope you have good vacation plans for when this is all over.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm waiting for that day, Scott. I'm waiting for it.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we continue on Connections now, turning our attention from the river of whatever it is that flows through Albany on a daily basis to the river that flows through downtown Rochester on a daily basis. The Genesee River, of course, is much more than just the scenery that we have out our back door here in the High Falls. It is also a vital part of life for a lot of people along a big stretch of New York State and even into Pennsylvania. And this hour, for the remainder of this hour, we are going to be talking about the Genesee River Basin Summit, hosted by Genesee River Watch, taking place on Wednesday, June 17th, the second time that they've hosted that. And in studio with us to talk about that and about a lot of issues affecting the Genesee River, David Zorn, the Executive Director of the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Planning Council. George Thomas is the Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Initiatives. And I promise I'm only going to read all of this once. Ben Schmidt is the Assistant State Conservationist for Field Operations of the National Resources Conservation Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, based in Batavia. Thank you all for being in here today and talking about this. And I guess let's kind of back this up and start with last year's event. It's always dangerous. Officially, the linguists will say you never call something the first annual because you don't know yet if there's going to be a second. Let's start by talking about how last year's event came together and what some of the takeaways from that were that led you to do it again.
Sure. Thank you. It was in February last year. February in 2014, we had a big snowstorm. I remember we had the meeting up at the lake at the county facility up there. We had about 185 people come, which was pretty good, representing approximately 80 different organizations. And we felt that we were going to have another one, so we felt comfortable calling it the first annual. We're committed to this. We've established this Genesee River Watch Initiative and felt this was a good opportunity to bring all the stakeholders together and the interested parties.
You have a lot of people who have a stake one way or another in what happens with the Genesee River, and I mentioned off the top, we think of it as being the pretty scenery out back, but there's a lot of river that drains a lot of area. Give me some sense of the scope of what we're talking about in terms of the number of people who are actually in a drainage basin of the river or one of its tributaries and are affected by what happens there.
Sure. I'll give you a little bit. Maybe David can help, too. Genesee River starts in Gold, Pennsylvania, about 160 miles from here. So it starts as a very small stream, and it works its way all the way down to Rochester that we see here coming through the city. It's about 2,500 square miles of land. It covers quite a bit of Allegheny County, Livingston County, Wyoming County, and Monroe. And I think I said Wyoming County, but so it covers that area. Most of the southern part is agriculture, as we probably know, and David and Ben can speak to that. Then you get to Rochester, and what we see here is the result of all the things that happen upstream.
So what are the concerns by the time the water gets here and makes its way through the city? What's it bringing with it?
Well, our main focus, and let someone else speak too, the main focus is for sediment and phosphorus. Sediment, you can see the color of the river. That's because of quite a bit of the erosion that goes on down in the southern part of the watershed. So a lot of the river just keeps cutting away at the banks and brings that material downstream, which causes a good part of the problem that we see here. And it carries both the sediment, the soil, and the phosphorus and nitrogen that go along with it.
Who else wants to jump in on this?
Well, I think the easy answer on that one is everything that nature and humans put into it,
yeah.
But then it gets a little more complicated based on what you're using the water for and what you're using the river for.
Yeah.
So in this case, with agriculture, you've got runoff that you're concerned about from farming. Mm-hmm. Would be one of the concerns. Yeah. What else?
Well, the main thing, like in the upper Genesee, we're concerned about the sediment, because that landscape is, it's a very sensitive landscape, and it's highly erosive if it's farmed. And then, of course, the phosphorus. And the interesting thing about the Genesee River, which I always try to bring up to my colleagues, is the Mount Morris Dam, and that changes the dynamics of the river, you know, because we're controlling the water a little bit more. So we always have to factor that into our scenarios also.
On the one hand, it's changing the dynamics. On the other hand, when we see the kind of flooding that we've been seeing just in the last day or two, there was a time when that could have come all the way through Rochester, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the dam, it's so unusual that the sole purpose of it is for flood control, which we have to remind people of that too. Mm-hmm. So,
and this is a river that has been dammed pretty consistently going back almost 200 years for hydropower as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is sort of the whole reason why we're sitting here in Rochester with a giant mill wheel behind us. David, you're the executive director of the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Planning Council. Give me a sense, you know, we mentioned it at the beginning, there are 85 river stakeholder organizations. With the number of regional governments that are involved, who all do you have to work with?
Well, we work with the nine counties of the region directly, and so that includes a good portion of the Genesee River counties down to the southern tier, but not including the southern tier. So, you know, Wyoming, Livingston, up to Monroe, little bit of Orleans are in that watershed. But then each of those counties, and we work directly with a lot of those municipalities, each one of those counties have 20-something municipalities in and of themselves. So it's a large number of cities, towns, and villages, as well as the counties that they are in.
That all have a role to play, and that each have their own concerns. Mm-hmm. And we saw the pictures. I was watching TV last night, and you saw those pictures that were coming from Honeyoy of flooding there, and further down outside our basin, we saw Watkins Glen getting affected and some areas around there. When we see the kind of weather that we've been seeing, and you see the kind of rains, you had mentioned erosion before, George, as being a concern. Does this sort of weather add to concerns with issues like erosion? Does this
make it
more difficult
to maintain
river quality?
Well, you can see the high. Matter of fact, we were going to paddle the river last week, but the rainfall made it difficult to do because it rises and falls with the different rain that we get. So some of the tributaries actually that drain into the river send a lot of water in also and do quite a bit of erosion, not just the main stem. One thing I did forget to mention, though, we talked a lot about erosion, and that's certainly a focus, but there's 30-some wastewater treatment plants that discharge into the river that have a role to play in this. We have individual citizens who have septic systems that don't go to a treatment plant that play a role in this. And so there's a lot of other activities. Plus, there's development, new development. There's a whole issue about stormwater control and that sort of thing. So just like we talked about. So there's a lot of issues that are at play. It's not just the erosion and agriculture. There's all other pieces that people can contribute to this issue that we see.
It's amazing to me, on a regional level, if we were having this conversation out west, it would be a completely different conversation.
Yeah, it certainly would, yeah.
Wouldn't even be worrying as much about water quality as about having any available even to do anything with. We want to invite you into the conversation as well, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or you can tweet me, different address today because Evan's not here, but you can tweet me at Scott Feibusch. We'll get the email working again for tomorrow as well. But right now, give us a call. Don't wait till the end of the hour so that we can get you in if you've got a question about the Genesee River and about the Genesee River Basin Summit that Genesee River Watch is hosting coming up on Wednesday. And that is what we are talking about this hour with David Zorn, George Thomas, and Ben Schmidt. Let's talk agriculture a little bit. Again, from the perspective sitting here in the city, we don't necessarily think so much about what's happening further up the river. Give us a sense of how much of Western New York's economy is still tied up with agriculture, and especially as it affects what happens in the Genesee River Basin.
Well, it's huge for Western New York. Even the governor has been, or the state and the governor have been pushing, you know, to support agriculture in the Western New York. I don't have the numbers. Maybe Dave does, but Just the businesses that are supported, you know, the jobs that are created, you know, all the, basically we're, you know, they're developing or creating raw commodities to sell. So that's where the economy starts. You know, it's just like drilling for oil or, well, not just like drilling for oil, but it's, you know, starting from scratch, basically. So we're creating all these products that other people are going to use. So it's a big deal. It really is. And since, you know, you brought up the Western situation with the California drought situation, that puts more pressure on the farmers here because in the Northeast we have roughly 20% of the population of the whole country and only 5 to 6% of the farmland. So it's going to put a lot of pressure on the farmers to grow fresh fruits and vegetables if we want fresh fruits and vegetables. So we're going to try to have to balance that.
To the extent we can. I don't think we're going to have almond trees here.
Now. Right. No.
But if you look at the nine counties of the region, and the Genesee River Basin counties are certainly representative of that, we are in the top of just about every ag category in this region. And as I said, the Genesee River Basin counties are representative of that. And that's not just cash crop fruit, but also livestock. There's a tremendous amount of livestock in the Genesee River Basin alone. We were talking about it before the show. Some of the counties like Livingston and Wyoming are big livestock counties. So that definitely plays a part. And that's also one of the reasons why when you go from production up to consumption, you see that this region is very heavy in the processing and food and beverage sort of economic cluster, because there's so many dollars at all ends of that spectrum from production through post-consumption. We really are the breadbasket of New York State.
Educate me a little bit on what the impact of all of that then becomes on the river that runs through us. You've got obviously issues with fertilizer runoff. If you're dealing with livestock, you've got issues with controlling their waste. What else plays into trying to maintain water quality when you've got all this active and essential agriculture going on around it?
Well, the first thing I would like to add, and I'll let Ben speak, though, is one of the things we talk about when we talk about erosion in agriculture, farmers are losing their property to the river. I mean, we've done some work, and you can see over a 10-year period fairly significant losses of very productive farmland. So the river's taking that away and sending it downstream here. So that's a issue beyond just the fact that it's eroding. We're losing valuable farmland and sending it out to the lake. The other issues, maybe let Ben add to that?
Well, anytime we disturb the landscape, we're going to have to do something to mitigate those disturbances. So every farming operation, it's a balance between production and maintaining their soil quality and soil health, which relates to good water quality. And more recently, you know, the agency I worked for kind of came out of the Dust Bowl. And so we're finally kind of going back to our roots and really focusing on soil health and making sure we have soil, quality soil, you know, for future generations and for current generations. So it's really critical for a farming operation, if they want to keep it in the family and to keep it going, to maintain their soil quality and their soil health.
Okay. Let's go to the phones here. We've got some questions at 844-295-TALK. Jane in Rochester, you're on with Connections.
Yes, something that really concerns me that was discussed quite a while back, but has disappeared, was the discovery to the public of Kodak having built a secret nuclear power plant, and no one ever said that I heard where that was located. And since there were so many problems with Kodak Park being polluted and so forth, it's right there at the Genesee River. And of course now Kodak Park is being turned into a recreation center for families. But I just want to ask your guests, where is the nuclear power plant located? Is it on the Genesee? Thank you.
We're getting some questions here. Thanks for the call. I think my recollection was actually on the Kodak Park property that's still pretty heavily industrially used, but it's not, you know, we think of Ginay using Lake Ontario as its cooling source. I don't think this was as much water cooled as we think of with Ginay.
Can't recollect anything there.
No, certainly nothing right on the right on the river itself.
Well, certainly Kodak has embarked on a program to look at what's happened in the river. They're doing a big study on the river this year to be able to determine what legacy effects they have, which don't have anything to do with the phosphorus and nitrogen that we're talking about. You know, it has to do with the organics and heavy metals that they were discharging over the years, and what do we need to do to clean up the lower part of the river from high falls or lower falls down.
And at the same time, Kodak Park is being turned into Eastman Business Park.
Right.
So there's a lot of action, as George pointed out, and also a lot of land action going on there.
Yep.
I thank a tweeter who just told us it was in the basement at the research labs.
Okay.
That's where it was. Thanks, Dave, for that.
Yep.
Appreciate it.
That's good to know.
Another question from Joanne in Scottsville, you know, as we get to these issues you mentioned before about erosion, George, and taking away, actual farmable land. Joanne is wondering what programs are available to landowners to help stabilize those banks. What's out there to help them keep their land from washing down the river?
Sure. I could speak to a couple, and I know that Ben and David can too. The federal government, I'll just talk about that at that level first. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative makes money available to do just this type of work, to reduce phosphorus and solids into the Lake Ontario, the Great Lakes. And so there's money available at a federal level. One of the problems you have with almost any project is you have to define it fairly clearly and estimate it and then bring it forward, so the whole process gets difficult. And that's kind of a role that we like to play, and I know David does too, where we try to help that farmer or the landowner put together a package that he can sell to the government agencies.
And I would say for the individual landowner, it probably makes sense, depending on the type of land that you're on, to get with a county agency that covers that land use and sort of try to package these together. Soil and water conservation districts do a very good job for ag lands, packaging a few of them together, going after federal dollars or even sometimes state dollars, and then doing the work efficiently and effectively along large stretches that may include several landowners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to add the soil and water districts for sure, and then also the Great Lakes Commission has grants available for nonprofits, and then the Natural Resources Conservation Service has a really popular conservation program called EQIP. It's the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and we run all our Great Lakes Restoration Initiatives money through that program, and it can do anything from cover crops to ag waste storage to grade stabilizations to grass waterways, and it's, you know, we reimburse folks anywhere from 50% to 75%. So there's lots of opportunities out there.
How much of a concern is it from the point of view of the lakes, when you're talking about that enormous volume of water that the Genesee and other rivers all flow into? How much of a concern is it that you've got this, you know, soil coming down the river and draining in? Are there dredging issues eventually that have to happen at the mouth? Is that the biggest concern from that?
I think here it depends who you are. The sediment definitely would be a dredging issue. The near shore waters in Lake Ontario are an issue. You know, the deeper waters aren't so bad. You know, we're fortunate Lake Ontario's deep, unlike Lake Erie. You know, they had a lot of algal bloom issues this past summer. So, you know, we have an opportunity to do something about it. So we're all here, you know, trying to put our heads together and work, you know, develop. It takes a lot of partnership. So, you know, George has done a great job developing the partnerships for the entire basin, which can be a challenge, you know, going across the county lines. So it's really huge.
And I do think we do have to do something. That's a good point. On the Lake Ontario lakeshore for dredging, because a lot of those areas really rely on those near shores, whether it be for boating or fishing, where the sediment has and continues to cause some significant problems, and dredging would certainly be a help there.
Are the water quality issues that are so often a problem at Ontario Beach, is that related at all to what's flowing out the mouth of the river?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole, like Ben mentioned, the near shore waters of Lake Ontario, almost from Niagara River all the way up to the St. Lawrence River, are listed as impaired for phosphorus. The concentrations are high. We see a lot of beach closing issues. And a lot of the tributaries, like the Genesee River, Oak Orchard Creek, Sodus Bay, those types of areas are experiencing algal blooms in the summertime because of the high nutrient loads.
We have Sue on the line with us from Fairport. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I like the host today.
Thanks.
I like him, too.
Yeah. he's very friendly. Host as a host to both the people in the studio, I'm sure. Sounds like it, and the callers.
You still get Evan back next Monday.
I'd be happy with that. My understanding is that the Hudson River Valley is very fertile as well. In fact, I know of two farms there actually, that actually serve New York City. They're really considered almost a suburb of the city. Is that correct, or is that just those two farms?
Oh, no, I'm not up on everything that's growing in the Hudson River Valley. I mean, yeah, the Hudson River Valley, but there is a significant amount of agriculture, especially, I think, fruit and some cash crop vegetables that are grown there. And mm-hmm. a large consumer of that is New York City because it's right downriver.
Right. Right. And horse farms, too, I think.
Yeah.
But I know of this one farmer, and it's because it is so close to the city, it's very lucrative.
Mm-hmm. But we can take a lot of our crops from this region and sell them to New York City too, you know.
Right. Oh, right. I mean, well, I'd be happy if they just had them here. I'm happy with what they'd have here. I mean, because I enjoy shopping locally. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Sue. 844-295-TALK is the phone number to join us. You can tweet me at Scott Feibusch. And just getting back once more to that question that Jane had earlier. About the nuclear plant, Jake on Twitter mentioned that it was not a power plant. It was a test reactor decommissioned years ago, very tiny, and there are no water usage issues involved, at least with that. So if that helps put somebody's mind at ease today, we hope it does. We hope you'll join us, too, at 844-295-TALK. We will continue with our conversation with George Thomas from the Center for Environmental Initiatives, Ben Schmidt from the USDA, and David Zorn from the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Planning Council. You are listening to member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 88.5, 91.5 HD2 in Rochester, 89.5 in the Finger Lakes, and WXXI.org, or the mobile app. We will be right back with our conversation right after this. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson on Tuesday's Connections. Trade issues are the hot topic in Washington and here in upstate New York as well. We'll have a preview of the upcoming Upstate New York Trade Conference, then a discussion of investigative reporting. The DNC's Sean Lehman and WXXI Innovation Trail editor Matthew Leonard are just back from the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference. We'll hear all about it. Join us Tuesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Ralph Honda, serving Rochester since 1933, offering new and pre-owned vehicles, including the 2015 Accord Family Sedan. Ralph Honda, Honda done right. RalphHonda.com.
We're back with Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson all week. We're talking about the quality of the Genesee River, about all of the various users, whether industrial, agricultural, recreational as well, who depend on the river for all kinds of various purposes. The Genesee River Basin Summit, second annual summit, is coming up on Wednesday, June 17th, at Temple Beth Kodesh in Brighton. And we have with us, talking about it, several of the participants and organizers, David Zorn from the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Planning Council, Ben Schmidt from the USDA, and George Thomas from the Center for Environmental Initiatives. And you're shaking your head, David. Did I get the wrong location there?
Yeah, the location is at SUNY Genesee.
At SUNY Genesee, I'm sorry.
SUNY Union on Wednesday, that's correct.
Juggling a whole bunch of upcoming events that we're talking about here. Okay, so SUNY Geneseo, it starts at 7:30.
Yes, in the morning, yeah.
In the morning, right, open to interested members of the public?
Absolutely. You can register online at our site, www.ceiinfo.org.
Okay.
Or the GenesseeRiverWatch.org.
CEIinfo.org. Pre-registration required. You can show up on the spot.
You can show up, but we prefer because we'd like to get a head count for breakfast. We're providing breakfast.
Excellent.
Yep.
It runs until 4. In addition to you guys who are all on the panel, who else are people going to hear from at this event on Wednesday?
We're going to hear from state people in Albany, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. It'll actually be Steve Gladding. We'll speak about a project that they've worked on since our summit, actually. One of the things that came out of our first summit was the need to have an overall plan for the Genesee River. And the DEC was able to put together a 9-element plan, which helped others put together funding opportunities. So that's part of that. David's going to speak about a couple watershed plans that we have going on in Black Creek and Awatka Creek that he's worked on. Charlie Knopf from Monroe County Health Department is going to talk about the Rochester embayment and an area of concern. And then Ben's going to speak on, and he'll tell us a little bit more later about some funding that's available specifically for the Genesee River. I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing, what we've done up to this point, but our main focus is going to be on our report card.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What sort of metrics do you use? Where do you turn for information to figure out, okay, what's going on here that even needs to be addressed? What are
you
looking at?
Sure. Well, report card is not something new. We didn't invent that. A lot of other people do that. They've done that on the Hudson River, as a matter of fact. They have a report card there. That was really the birthplace of these kinds of integrated basin efforts. The Riverkeeper organization did that. We're interested in collecting information on the state of the river that allows people to understand what's going on in the river in a simple, fairly simple way, so they can say, oh, gee, I didn't know that, or no, I understand that, but also then provide a basis for conversation. And then set some targets. Where should we be? And so we're going to be looking at things like traditional water quality. You know, we've talked about phosphorus and sediment and that sort of thing, and those are fairly straightforward. The state puts that stuff together quite a bit. But the other thing we would like to do is we also like to highlight all the different things that people have a stake in the water quality. You know, we've talked a lot about agriculture. For years, they've been doing a lot. I mean, agriculture has been doing things for, I don't know how long, it's been years. They've had the agriculture environmental management. They have the concentrated animal feeding operations, have state permits that require them to manage their material. So there's a lot of activity that's going on now that we want to give credit to. But then there's other things that are or are not being done as well. Things like septic systems and making sure that those are operated and maintained properly, to make sure that stormwater management is done properly, and that we have some conservation activities. And then ultimately, what have we got planned for this watershed? So those are the general categories, and that's how we're going to approach it coming up at the summit, is talk about these broad categories, throw out our ideas about what we think, but then also solicit input from the different stakeholders and say, hey, this is what we're trying to do. What do you think? What do you think we should measure? Overall, though, we don't want to create a new set of data collection. We really want to use data that's available. We don't want to go out because we don't have the means to do it, and I don't think anybody really needs to because there's already a lot of data out there.
Let's talk, for instance, phosphorus is a big issue, both in terms of the levels that are in the river and in terms of what's available to help farmers mitigate what's coming off of their land. Ben, you had mentioned during the break that there are some resources that are available there to help farmers.
Yeah, over the winter at our Great Lakes Restoration Initiative meetings, you know, they were really focused on Western Lake Erie. So we got a little concerned that they would suck up all the money. So we thought we need some for Lake Ontario to help deal with our issues here and to create some new opportunities. So we put together a proposal quickly, over a period of 4 to 5 years, and there's opportunities to get more of it. So far this year, we received $1.9 million in financial assistance, you know, for agricultural producers. Some of that, about half of that, is specifically just for the Upper Genesee and the Canasarauga and the Black Creek watersheds. And then we also have some money for the entire Genesee River Valley, plus the Lake Ontario Lake Plains on the flanks on the east and west of the Genesee River. So there is an opportunity for all those areas, but we're really trying to focus in on the Upper Genesee and the Canasarauga to keep things in place up there. So in the upper reaches of the watershed, if we can start with good water will end up down here in Rochester.
So what actually goes into that? What does this money actually pay for?
It pays for it pays for basically doing capital improvements on the land. Our staff would help farmers identify resource concerns or environmental issues, you know, like water quality issues or soil quality issues, and then we would put together a conservation plan, and then once we have a decent plan in place, we can turn it into what we call a conservation contract, and then they agree to do certain things, and then we agree to reimburse them for those activities like cover crops, you know, no-till, grade stabilization, grass waterways, waste storage facilities, things like that. But we also want to try some new things like some denitrifying bioreactors, which is kind of a new kind of in stream right next to the edge of the field. So we would capture the water, let the microbes denitrify the nitrogen, let it go back into the atmosphere, and then, you know, let the cleaner water go downstream. And we're also trying to do that with phosphorus. So we're trying to capture some of these, you know, as they leave the field in the worst case scenarios.
Are these fairly new technologies?
Yeah. The phosphorus removal systems we don't even have the ability to cost share them yet, hopefully for next fiscal year. But the denitrification bioreactors are a little bit older, and they've had some experience with them. Yeah.
Talk about phosphorus specifically. Obviously it's something that you don't want coming down the river and flowing into the lake. Why?
Well, it's turned into the limiting nutrient for algae. It used to be nitrogen, but now there's so much nitrogen. And we've often done a good job with phosphorus. But now phosphorus is a limiting factor. And so it's been a challenge. Because over time, if the phosphorus builds up in the soil, it'll start to be released. And I guess the challenging part is phosphorus historically, well, it's a compound that will tie to the soil very strongly. So we're not used to thinking of it as something that gets released easily. But as the phosphorus levels get like over 300 pounds per acre, then the chemistry, the equilibrium changes, and more of the soluble phosphorus will get into the water. And once it's in the water, it tends to stay in the water, unless there's an opportunity for it to settle to the bottom of a lake or something, you know, that's deep enough where it won't get disturbed back up into the water column.
What does it mean the state has this 303D list of streams that are impaired for total phosphorus? What does that mean in plain English?
Well, the state is obligated by the federal government, the EPA, and the Clean Water Act to identify all of the streams that are in all of the basins, that applies to the whole state, that might be what they call impaired, that there's something wrong with it that impairs its use. And phosphorus is one of the impairments that causes eutrophication, it causes algal blooms and all those issues. Sediment is also one, and there's a lot of other ones. So they create a formal list. They try to keep it up to date. They certainly haven't covered all of the streams that are in New York State. It's quite a formidable task, but they keep chipping away at it. So that's a formal list that we use. And then the obligation then is to follow up with, okay, you've said that it's impaired for these materials. What are we going to do about it? And they just did a study on Black Creek, on Upper Black Creek, a year or two ago to look at what we could do there. And they put together what they call a TMDL, total maximum daily load. So they try to figure out, well, who's contributing to all these issues and who should do something about it.
And what kind of resources presumably are available to actually address it.
Yep.
It's Connections, a member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We're talking with George Thomas from the Center for Environmental Initiatives, Ben Schmidt from the USDA, and David Zorn from the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Planning Council. And you as well at 844-295-TALK. Or you can tweet me at Scott Feibusch. We seem somehow to keep coming back to this Kodak nuclear plant, even though we've established it really doesn't have a lot to do with river quality. But just to make sure the questions are answered, Bill in Rochester, you worked there, right?
I did, and I was an electrician in Building 48, and which is where Kodak did the electroplating of their chill roll. And in that building, they had some really heavy metals, chromic acid, nickel oxide, anything to do with electroplating. They had a large trench in the middle of the building in case of a chemical spill. And my job was to make sure that a monitoring device at the end of that trench was making a paper tape recording of the water that flow out through that building that was at a certain pH level of, I think it was between 4 and 7.2. Anytime an acid got in that trench, an alarm went off, and they would shut it down. I will tell you this. You can flush 1 million gallons of clean water, and you can get rid of 1,000 gallons of chromic acid in one afternoon. They did that often because those tanks leaked a lot. That's what that trench was in there for. So I know for a fact that Kodak deliberately pushed heavy metals into that Genesee River because they made the phone call to the people down on the lower level saying, we are flushing our trench and let it bypass straight through to the river. I witnessed that a number of times in there. I was an outside contractor working for Electrical Concern, and that was my job to take care of that that metering.
Bill, so what kind of time frame are you talking about?
Who knows? But they should have gone to jail for that.
Bill, what kind of time frame was this happening in?
Let's see. Kodak was still up and running. They were still making film. The 401 machine was still printing. They were still repairing chill rolls and using electroplating to put the metal back on those chill rolls, and then they would turn them in a lathe to smooth them out. So I'm going to say, 80s.
Into the 80s?
In the 80s.
Interesting.
80 through 85.
Well, thanks thanks for the call. Yeah. Appreciate it.
I was in Building 48 for about 4 years.
Okay.
And I witnessed that a number of times.
Well, thanks for the call, Bill. That's certainly, we were talking about the Hudson before, and certainly that's been an ongoing issue with the Hudson, with all the contamination with the PCBs from General Electric and everything else that's been dumped in there. Are we still dealing with impact here in Rochester from industrial uses of the river?
Again, I just bring up the study that's going on that DEC and EPA have agreed to do with Kodak on the river from the lower falls all the way to the mouth of the river to study what has been the impact of all those operations over all the years. And then they're obligated then to fix or deal with whatever is found. Kodak put up $50 million, I think, and the state put up another $50. Then Kodak said we would take care of more. So there's a commitment there to do whatever the studies yield. So I think at the end of this year we'll know, and it seems like a pretty thorough study.
Is that surprising to hear? I mean, you certainly hear about all of these things happening in the 50s and 60s.
Yep.
Is it surprising to hear that stuff was still being dumped in those kind of volumes, supposedly as late as the mid-80s?
Well, I used to work at Kodak from 73 to 2006, and I actually worked in the environmental arena there and also worked at the wastewater treatment plant that he refers to. There's different perspectives to look at those things. I think Kodak had a commitment, it seemed to me at the time, to try to do what was right, try to meet permit limits. The calls that were made to the wastewater treatment plant was an attempt to say, hey, we made a mistake in production. Do you have an opportunity to divert that stream? And that's what Kodak had. They had a stormwater holding tank that they were able to divert that, hold it, and then treat it. So there were things that they were trying to do to try to minimize the impact. Not to say that they didn't do things in the past, but I think they're willing to own up to it and try to make something happen.
Okay. Go back to the phone. Scott in Canandaigua, you're on with Connections. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I recently moved to the Bristol Hills area, and I'm assuming my water eventually makes it to the Genesee or certainly Lake Ontario. And we have a quarter-acre pond on our property, and in the past it's been clear and swimmable. But this year, suddenly we've had a lot of algae blooms, and I've been told it's more phosphorus than nitrogen. So as a homeowner, what can we do to kind of manage our own little ecosystems before the water, overflows and then makes it to the Genesee? I was told to add cattails. That kind of eats the nitrogen, I think. But other people say, oh, you don't want cattails because they take over the pond. So what can we do as homeowners to help with our own little water source, if you will?
Well, I'll just add one thing first, I guess, is that you really need to look at where the water comes from. That's really what's causing your problem. What's upstream of your pond? What kind of activities are going on?
Yeah, that has been the first question. And actually, the landscape has been graded really well. We're actually only get rainwater in. There's actually been drainage systems put in, so there's no runoff that makes it into our pond, or very little, just from our own grass and lawn area, which we don't fertilize. But all the everything upstream is, you know, hits the gully and is diverted around the pond. So that's it could be coming from the rainwater. Is the rainwater acid rain kind of thing, or I just don't know anything about it. But
not likely. One thing I would recommend it if you call the Canandaigua Watershed Protection Alliance. There's a gentleman there named Steve Lewandowski. He could probably, you know, he'd be willing to go out there and take a look at it probably and help you out, because it is can be a complex issue. Without seeing it, it's hard to determine.
Yeah, and if you're
Canandaigua Water Alliance.
Canandaigua Watershed Protection Alliance, I think it's called.
And if you're mowing grass or applying any kind of fertilizer, I would take a hard look at that.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call, Scott. Kind of expanding on that, sort of on a more general level, you know, we think of these as being issues that big industry or agriculture has to address. What should any of us be thinking about, you know, with my little lawn in Brighton, what should I be thinking about where that water goes and about how to make sure that I am doing, like Scott said, my little part to preserve things?
Well, one of the things we have the benefit in Monroe County is the Water Hero, H2O Hero, and if you Google that, you'll find it. They put a great program together to help homeowners understand what they can do to what their impacts are and what they can do to mitigate those impacts. So certainly New York State took the initiative and took phosphate out of our laundry detergent. They took it out of fertilizers, lawn fertilizers. So there's a lot of things that have gone on, but there's still other activities that people take part in that could do that. And I suggest Water Hero is a good place to do that.
Yeah, H2O Hero, and of course, what you put on your lawn and how much you mow up to the stream. Mm-hmm. In other words, it'd be real nice if you had some sort of buffer in there. If you're a landowner that owns property that goes up to a water body, to not have the lowest vegetation, i.e. grass, into that water body, but rather have more, have higher forms of vegetation with buffering in there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's been a powerful reminder. You walk around, you see the little placards by the drains that reminds you, flows to lake, flows to river. My son, who's in first grade, is fascinated by those.
Mm-hmm. You want to keep it as natural as possible.
Yep.
It's really, and know your soil test phosphorus level. So work with the extension on that. You don't want it to go over 40 pounds per acre. So,
because all that does go somewhere eventually,
yep.
even if you don't think about it.
Yep.
We have a question from Aria on Twitter, who was wondering whether there are any women who are involved in the panel that's coming up at Geneseo on Thursday.
This particular panel, we don't. We don't. There aren't any women involved on the panel this year. There's a lot of participants who are soil and water conservation districts, DEC people. A lot of the people, the volunteers that are helping us are women. We've had quite a bit of support from Women of Water to help, you know, the recognition of that we've been working to try to help improve the quality of the water.
It is one of those issues that affects everybody regardless.
Sure. Yep.
Absolutely. So, again, we want to make sure that we get the information out for people who might be interested in attending the second annual Genesee River Basin Summit. It's taking place Wednesday at Geneseo.
Mm-hmm.
Got the location correct now. Tomorrow we'll be discussing the event that's taking place in Brighton that I mentioned earlier. This one is at SUNY Geneseo. Where do you go when you get there?
You go to the Student Union. There's actually a map on our site. It shows you where the conference is and where the parking is. And so if you go to our website, you can get that information. It's pretty clear. The parking's free. The event is free, but you have to bring your own lunch or you can eat lunch out. So.
And ceinfo.org is the website for, okay, George Thomas, Executive Director. Let me close out in our remaining, we got about 2 minutes left here in the show. We were talking a little bit about some of the resources that are available. How sufficient are they? How much more would you really need if you wanted to get to a point where you can say very confidently, you know what? What's flowing out at the mouth of the river is meeting every quality standard we can come up with. We're taking care of making sure that we don't have huge erosion problems. What kind of funding would you need beyond what's already there, and what kind of resources would you need?
I'll take a shot at it first, I think. There's a lot. One of the things we found when we got into this, there's a lot of people involved. I mean, David's organization, the Soil and Water Conservation District, counties, watershed groups, everybody is there trying to do a little piece of it. And what we're hoping is that if we kind of work together and define the problems on a whole basin-wide basis, which we're starting to do now, so I think that's a good step direction. Plus, there is funding being made available. Ben's been able to secure funding. The federal government has always had funding. The state has, but you got to have a project. You got to have something that people buy into and that local government people buy into. And so I think as we work to try to do that, more people get involved. I think that we can have a good shot at it.
Ben, you want to take a stab at it?
Well, I think a lot of times, you know, we talk about in agriculture, we only use the land for like 3 to 4 months out of the year, and we're trying to get people to grow things on another 3 or 4 or even more months. So when we're growing, you know, even if it's just a cover crop, kind of in the off season or through the winter, that's when we see that in a lot of places across the landscape, that's when I'm convinced that we're making good progress. So it's going to take a little bit of a cultural shift to do that.
As it is really in agriculture all over the country in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Dave?
Well, I would just piggyback what George said. And, you know, what we're trying to do as much as possible is assess it first, figure out what you need, and then figure out how you're going to measure what you're going to do so that when you do it, you can show the success.
All right. And again, the Genesee River Basin Summit takes place on Wednesday at SUNY Geneseo. There is more info at ceinfo.org. Thanks to our guests, George Thomas from the Center for Environmental Initiatives, Ben Schmidt from the USDA, and David Zorn from the Genesee Finger Lakes Regional Planning Council. Our thanks also to Caitlin Madison, our producer for this hour. Thanks so much for your hard work on this, and to Vail, our engineer. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. This is Connections from member-supported public radio.